This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
You are on the Escape Hour. This is Fiona and I'm here with Stefan. Welcome to the program, Stefan.
Thank
lovely
you.
Lovely to see
Thanks,
you.
Fiona. It's lovely to be here.
We've both been travelling, as yes. is you would expect from people that run a radio program about travel and food. Yeah. We would be remiss if we were not travelling on a regular basis. It's our raison d'être, as they say. Did I say that right, Stefan?
Yes, raison d'être. Yeah, perfect.
Our reason to exist. Stefan, tell me, where were you recently?
I went away for 2.5 weeks, Singapore, Kuala Lumpur and Philippines, different places in the Philippines.
And this was work-related?
Was work-related, yes.
But you did get some time out?
I did get some time off a little bit, one weekend out of three, which was lovely.
They certainly keep you busy in that job, don't they?
Yeah, a lot of things happen at the weekend, so yeah.
Well, welcome back.
Thank you. And you've been...
I have also been away. I was in Tunisia.
Oh.
Yes, that was a bit of a... that was a real jaunt. I was there for 2 weeks.
And it's a long way to go. I stayed in Southeast Asia. You went all the way to near Europe. Not Europe, clearly, but...
It's almost there.
Almost there.
It's almost there. In fact, I asked a young Tunisian if he felt like he was African or European, and he said definitely European. Mm. But more about our travels later.
Yes.
We have a guest in the studio today. Welcome to Michelle Matthews. How are you, Michelle?
I'm fantastic. Thanks for having me.
Well, Michelle's been on the program, listeners, before, if you may recall, talking Spain, because I know that you're a real Spanophile. I don't know if that's such a name.
I think it's good enough. People know what you mean.
Yes. Well, I think that everyone should spend more time thinking about Spain. But today, that's not what we're talking about. You have just returned yourself from a trip to Java, Yogyakarta, Surakarta, Borobudur, and one more temple.
Prambanan.
Prambanan.
Easy to trip your words over that one with the syllables, but Prambanan.
So I know that you're a regular Bali goer, and listeners, I have just recently also come back from the Ubud Food Festival in Bali, where I was travelling, and Michelle was at the same festival. In fact, she brought me to the festival for the first time the year before. So we have her to thank for all of these wonderful Indonesian food experiences. But you travelled on after the Ubud Food Festival, Michelle, to Yogyakarta, otherwise known as Yogya. Is that correct?
Jogja. Mostly, yes. The Indonesians seem to like shortening a lot of the cities. So Surakarta is almost universally known as Solo. Not that it seems like an obvious contraction of the name, but it's always referred to as Solo until you look on a map and then it's still Surakarta. So it's a bit tricky, that one.
Well, they do have longer names for their cities and towns.
They do, and a lot of them sort of overlap. So Surakarta, Jakarta, Yogyakarta, etc. Mm. So they sort of just get to the meat of it by talking about Jogja, for example, or Solo.
I mean, I have not had the pleasure of being to Java or Jakarta. I think I had a stopover in Jakarta once, but I don't think I got out of the airport. However, Yogyakarta has always been in my mind as a place, a home of the arts and culture in Indonesia, and a must visit.
Well, it's quite a beloved city by Indonesians because it is quite a historic city. It's the only part of, the main part of Indonesia, I suppose, that has a monarchy that exists. So it's a special region. It's not like other parts of Indonesia. So it has still an active monarchy and you can visit the palace. So it's different in that sense. So the area that we're specifically referring to is Central Java. So Java is a very, very big island. It's not the biggest in Indonesia, but it certainly is by population. So it's got more than half the population of the whole country. So from that perspective, it's quite substantial. So people refer to East, Central, West, and Jakarta's in Northwest. So I thought this time, after spending so many years visiting Bali frequently, that it would be, you know, one small step for man, one giant step for Australia kind by going to Java and actually seeing a little bit more. And it's compellingly different. So as much as we adore Bali, pretty much all our whims are catered for. That's not the case with Java. It's
good
it's
to
different.
Be, yeah, it's good to have your, as a regular traveller, to have your travel muscles stretched a little bit.
Absolutely.
So, what do you mean by all your needs are not catered for? I'm not quite sure what you mean by that.
Well, as I flew back to Bali, then on my way home to Australia, I think I had a 10 a.m. pedicure with a bintang, for example.
Okay.
Now, that's not something you're going to find without a great lot of effort, and it might not be an option there. So, you know, it is a Muslim country, and it's back to business. You know, Bali is the alternative, being a Hindu island, but the rest of it is a Muslim country. Not that it's as overt as you might imagine in Middle Eastern countries, perhaps, but it certainly is a factor. And so drinking just isn't part of the culture.
When was it the Ramadan when you went there?
I came back, I think, about 3 days before, but they were gearing up for it.
Yes, we'll discuss Ramadan more extensively because I was in Tunisia during Ramadan. Yes. That was interesting experience. However, you skipped it this time. So I'm assuming also the other component is, of course, you are not... Yogyakarta, of course, is well set up for tourists, though, because it is a very popular tourist destination.
It is. You do see tourists, but a lot of them look still more local, more Indonesian tourists than anything else, I would say. So Borobudur is the big temple. It is the visual icon that people see when they see temples in Indonesia. And it's quite a distinctive shaped Buddhist temple that they claim is the biggest in the world. It's really quite a spectacular temple to see. And so it draws people by the thousands from right across Indonesia and, of course, you know, beyond.
And how does Borobudur compare to Angkor Wat, for example, in Cambodia?
It's not as big, but it's quite, a different construction and shape. Now, I have been to Angkor Wat, and I believe, was it a bit of a hybrid sort of at times Hindu and Buddhist?
You know, I'm going to have to look that up.
I think we both might need to look that up.
Angkor Wat.
So this one is sort of a purely Buddhist one, and it's really, it's just very beautiful, very peaceful. It's not completely intact, like so many of these temples. You know, they have been plundered to some extent, and you can see a lot of the Buddhas have had their heads removed, the ones that were more accessible. But it's still, like, it's quite a spectacular temple. Now, Yogyakarta and Central Java is a pretty hot part of the world, so it's a very popular thing to see at dawn, which means getting up very early to be there. Nevertheless, I don't think anyone's ever going to see the place without, you know, hordes of crowds. So when I was there, I'm not sure if it was because it was the lead-up to Ramadan, but there were certainly probably countless buses of teenagers, school teenagers, all in their colourful matching T-shirts visiting the temple. So,
That would have been, it could have been fun to have all those teenagers running around, or it could have been annoying. I guess it depends.
It was a bit of both. My travelling companion was blonde and Amazonian, and she couldn't really move two paces without wanting a photograph with her.
Of course, yes. Exhibition A. It's quite fun. I think that's really fun. I'm like, yeah, I'll jump in a photo.
Day one, it's fun. Day two, it slows you down.
Did you stay? I know that you can stay at a hotel near Borobudur, or did you bus trip in from Jogja?
I did stay at a hotel nearby, so it was really just a few kilometres away. It was called the Plateran, which is an Indonesian chain of hotels. It was actually just a spectacular hotel. I loved it. It's a luxury hotel, but some of them sort of just get under your skin a little bit more than others, and this was very much one of those. It was Indonesian, certainly in the cuisine, that you could try very comfortably a lot of different sorts of dishes that were local, and specifically local, not just nasi goreng, mie goreng, etc. And, you know, it, Java is a beautiful part of the world as well. I think there's more than 100 volcanoes just in Java.
Well, there is one of the most active volcanoes is near Borobudur called Mount Merapi, I believe. Did you explore that as well?
I didn't have the time to explore that. I certainly would like to.
Well, I think that we should probably save that conversation for just after this break. You're on the Escape Hour, and we are talking to Michelle Matthews today about Java.
Joy 94.9 is on air 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. But sometimes you can't always be with us when you want to. Here's the solution. Here's the solution. Listen to your favourite Joy 94.9 show anytime with our Joy podcast service. Our team of over 30 volunteers pick out the best bits from around 60 programs that Joy airs each week, made available to you for free download. To find a podcast of your favourite Joy show, search for us in the featured providers section within the iTunes store, or find them on the Joy website, joy.org.au. Joy Podcasts. Any show, anytime, joy.org.au.
So it was all 5 stars and during that trip?
It wasn't. That's not really how I enjoy travelling for the most part. What I found really interesting about Java was just how many old buildings there are. In fact, they've got quite an impressive Art Deco history there. So you'll find a lot of Art Deco buildings around. It's had so many influences, so many invasions, I suppose, throughout the years, that there is influences from so many different countries and eras and fashions and tastes that probably relatively few buildings are of a pure design. But in Solo, in Surakarta, I stayed at a place called Romoko, which was a 1938 construction estate, a house quite close to the centre of town, but actually in the old area where they made the batik fabric, which is fascinating in its own right.
Did you visit some batik factories?
Kind of by accident, yes. Ah. So the first evening I went in there, I visited a particular museum, Dinar Hadi. That's the name of a particular brand of batik, and it is also a museum. And the museum was just fascinating. So if you're at all interested in the history of Indonesia, the artistry of this fabric and the symbolism of it, it's so worth going. It's just really quite extraordinary because there's the Dutch influence, the Japanese influence, the influence from the different areas, from coastal as well as the Yogyakarta area. There's so much wrapped up in the symbolism within the shirts and the fabric. So behind the hotel, they opened up a back door that I was sort of studying for Instagram, and it just opened up to this little laneway. And walking along there to go into town, I couldn't help but see inside more of a shed than a factory. And it turned out it was an active batik factory with about 6 men inside it, sweltering hot, because of course there's a lot of heat involved in making it, melting
the
wax.
Yes.
So do they have a special pattern in that place of Indonesia, or is it just traditional?
There are many, many special patterns. So at this particular museum, nobody was allowed to take any photographs and everyone was escorted through and guided. So you're not allowed to take photos because there's a lot of proprietary designs. There is a lot of symbolism and certain designs represent the royal family, or you can see that, you know, if they're very colourful, they might be more from a coastal area. Then there's certain colours that are more symbolic of, I suppose, traditional aspects. There's so much to it that you can read. And, of course, a lot of batik isn't actually batik. It's just conventional printing because there's a lot of work involved. There's about 7 processes.
That's so labour-intensive.
Very labour-intensive.
Well, as a fabric obsessive and craft obsessive, I would have just loved that. The techniques and the, of course, the end results, which, of course, then you can buy.
So,
did you purchase anything?
I didn't purchase anything.
That's what I'm getting to.
I didn't purchase anything that would be considered of batik, proper batik quality, but I did buy a couple of items, more so for modesty. I think as for a lot of us who don't live in tropical climates, to then be travelling around a tropical climate, you want to be as comfortable as possible, but also be mindful that this is a Muslim country. And so a lot of the women wear the hijab, and they seem to not notice just how hot it is. So they will wear jeans and full length, you know, things on their tops as well. So you don't really want to go that far, but you do want to be reasonably covered and respectful. So some of the, like a little batik skirt actually served me quite well.
Well, that's right. After coming from Bali, where, you know, there are sort of no such restrictions, or not that anyone would care to, you know, pay attention to, it is very important to dress appropriately when you go into countries where, you know, lots of leg or bare arms, and of course particularly when you're going into temples as well. I mean, now with Borobudur, we've established it's not we're segueing back and forth now. But onto that topic, it's not a working temple. So as such, was there a need for cover like there are when you visit some of the other temples, for example, in Bali?
Look, not really. And I found the Javanese were very relaxed about everything. Nobody questioned or commented. You didn't feel like you were looked at if you were wearing anything, you know, shorts, for example, or anything mildly inappropriate. But it was more just you didn't want to stand out for the wrong reasons. So in Borobudur and Prambanan, both of the temples, you really wanted to be a little bit protected from the sun as much as anything else.
Indeed.
Because it's quite scorching, which is why you want to sort of be done by 11 a.m. at the latest. But it's not obligatory.
For listeners who may have just tuned in, we're talking to Michelle Matthews, who is runs her own guidebooks, The Lucky Guides, and we are talking all about her recent trip to Java. Now, one of the things that we sort of skipped over, you mentioned some lovely guest houses.
Yes. So Romoko in Solo, Surakarta, was a beautiful 1938 Art Deco property. And just the beautiful details. It's still very much Indonesian in that you'll have more sort of a compound style setup of central buildings, large balconies, sort of the indoor-outdoor living, and then the enclosed rooms. There were so many details and so many places that I noticed across Java that included stained glass windows. That was a huge feature throughout.
So the stained glass windows, the motifs, were they kind of like Islamic designs, so that they were very much strongly patterned?
They were detailed, but no, I would say they were more Art Nouveau and Art Deco.
Oh,
but, but also they varied from different places.
It is a beautiful time, a beautiful art movement and architectural movement for sure.
And then quite embellished by, I suppose, being a little bit far from perhaps the source or the originating source of the inspiration for Art Deco. So the second place I stayed at Yogyakarta was a converted old palace. Well, not a palace, but a mansion, Ndalem Natan. So it's
well
owned,
done.
It's a bit tricky. I've been working on it. So a Jakarta couple, a bit of an Indonesian power couple, have bought this and owned it for the last 6 years or so. There was a massive earthquake in Yogyakarta in particular, which did a lot of damage. So they've been bringing it back to life. So it's about a 10-room property now. And it's just divine, absolutely divine. Lots of lush plants out the front. It's a bit of an art gallery as well with lots of historical details. But the lady of the house, Ita, she was explaining that, you know, this particular pylon represents elements of Islamic culture and Sufi culture, as well as Art Deco, and as well as, you know, the whims of the original owner. So it all comes together and it's really quite lovely.
So it blends. So it wasn't
beautiful.
Quite five stars, but it was still luxurious by the sound of it.
Well, look, it was. I mean, inside each of these rooms at this particular place in Yogyakarta, they had traditional Javanese-style wedding beds, which are four posters but completely covered and sort of unconventional shapes.
Oh.
And so lots of really, really interesting details everywhere you go. The furniture was stunning.
And very typical to the area, which is really good to when you travel to these places, because if you go to a lot of five stars, it's standards and you could be anywhere.
There's nothing worse than an impersonal, you know, hotel
and that
room
sounds
when you're
like
staying in a, you know, unique but culturally beautiful place.
It is difficult to find these places, though, for
if you're a tourist, you've never been there. So how do you find these guest houses? How do you know, have you got any tips to find these gems to stay in?
The main idea, I suppose, is if you search Art Deco, or there's the term Ndalem, so just small N, capital D, L-E-M, which I think means mansion. Mm. So that's just one word. And so if you search those, there are a few that are converted. Search Art Deco, as I said. When you look online for accommodation, certain buildings will jump out as being not conventional. And I think, like a lot of cultures that are relatively old, the locals are quite keen to visit places that are new, whereas for us, with a new culture, we appreciate the older ones.
Mm, mm, mm. Well, that is so true. I think it's just being a little bit forensic in your search, and most of these accommodations are online these days. So, you know, I must admit, some people just have a knack for choosing great accommodation, and other people just not quite the same knack. And unfortunately, I just think that's something you're either born
well, yes.
I don't know what to say about that.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLD TIQ community radio station Joy 94.9.
Here we are. This is the Escape Hour.
Escape Hour with our guest Michelle Matthews. And we're talking all about Indonesia, and more specifically Java or Yogyakarta and other places in Java. Now, we mentioned briefly food, but was there anything that... what you only find in this place? Where am I going? Now, Java, any food specific to this area? Anything specific to Yogyakarta? Or
there are a number of things. One thing I found was a reference to charcoal coffee, which just really intrigued me. You know, Melburnians can't stop talking about making coffee. Quite intrigued because I hadn't heard of this one. And so it's an evening thing. It's not an AM thing at all. So I had a couple of attempts to actually go to this place, and it's just part of a street food row of stalls. And it just appears from 5 p.m. onwards. So it's a traditional cup of coffee like they make in Indonesia. So they'll sort of mix the coffee with hot water, generous amounts of sugar. Normally I try and sort of, tidak gula, but this time I went with a bit of extra sugar because I knew there was going to be this charcoal and I thought the caramelization could be interesting. So sure enough, they've stirred the charcoal, stirred the coffee to make it beautiful hot, and then they reach into the stove that's got basically just a fire there and pull out sort of a smallish, a third of a banana sized piece of bright red charcoal and just put it straight in this glass of coffee. And of course it steams and bubbles up, and then they do it again with a second piece, and then it's presented to you on this saucer, and it's
like, how am I going to drink that? Now, we're assuming this is charcoal from wood.
Yes.
I mean, is it a special charcoal or a special wood? I mean, is it, like the Japanese charcoal?
My Bahasa Indonesia, the language wasn't really quite up to getting all the specifics.
And so can you drink it straight away?
Look at it for a while, you stir it a bit, and after a while it sort of, the temperature sort of becomes quite equal with the coffee itself, and you sort of fish out this piece of charcoal and the other piece of charcoal, and then you do sip on it. So the charcoal doesn't affect the taste all that much. It does sort of make it a little bit grainy, I suppose, a little bit of, but not in an unpleasant way. It was the coffee itself was great. I really enjoyed it. And it turns out it's very much an old-fashioned activated charcoal beverage. Mm. It's what they have. If you're feeling a little ill, it can sort of settle the stomach and, soak up toxins and flush them out. Yes. So that's...
Wow, that's extraordinary.
True. Exactly.
But why the evening, though? That's all the after 5 p.m. because maybe it removes the caffeine and it's...
Look, I suppose it's perhaps following a day of eating,
good
morning,
Very good point.
So do you think that we might see, charcoal coffee as a coffee trend in Melbourne?
I do not.
Sure? Because, we'll latch on to anything.
We will latch on onto anything, but for the full effect, it has to be profoundly unsafe.
Of course.
That wouldn't fly here.
I did think when you described it that the thing was going to explode
in your
face. That was the trick for the tourists.
Very, very special glass. They obviously trust the tourists and regular people just to, Move it over to the table.
And if you burn yourself, you won't be able to sue anybody.
No, exactly.
You can't sue McDonald's when your coffee's too hot. I mean, you can sue McDonald's when your coffee's too hot. Well, that sounds rather fascinating. And then some other food adventures along the way.
Well, one of the things, before I went over there, of course, I was chatting to Janet Denis from the Ubud Food Festival and Wayan, who is Chef Wayan from the Potato Head Group. And they were both talking about this other amazing food experience that they'd had in Yogyakarta. In fact, Janet had described it as her most extraordinary food experience, which made my mind spin. Exactly, exactly. And so they talked about this spicy catfish dish and this old lady who cooks it. And it took a little while before I found all the information, and it took again two times to get there. Traipsed out to the suburbs of Yogyakarta, down a little, basically a walkway, to find this house where Mangut Lele Maba Mato, which basically is this spicy catfish by Grandmother Mato, as she's known. So this elderly lady prepares this catfish dish, which is her specialty and has been for about 30 years or more. And this house is just four rooms. Two of them are where you eat. One room that you go through first is the cleaning room, where they just clean up the dishes. It has a proper well inside it. And they prepare
That's
the drinks. Exactly. So you walk through there and then you walk to the kitchen. A very much blackened room. It was so dark, with just shards of light sort of coming through, but it was so smoky, they were like lasers. And there was sort of an array of pots where the grandmother was squatting and hunched over and sort of swiveling back and forth, tending to all these fires, basically just made on the floor. And then on the other side of the room was a sort of an elevated table where they had a few other dishes laid out, like the good egg, the special jackfruit dish of the area, as well as some tofu dishes, opor ayam, the special chicken that they prepare there. And so it's just all happening. You grab your plate, put some rice on it. Another lady there will sort of put a couple of skewers of the catfish. You grab the rest and then take it out and eat.
Well, that does sound extraordinary. And so with the catfish, now often blackened catfish, if you think about the Southern American version, it has a spicy seasoning associated with it. So it's quite hot. I'm not sure whether they use exactly, there would be some element of chili, but it's hot and it's spicy and it's blackened. Is that sort of part of the blackened catfish story?
To an extent. So yeah, so it is very much sort of, I suppose, barbecued first. That's the one element of it. And on sort of like satay size skewers. Mm. But then there's another element. And so when I was there, she was grinding up the candle nuts and the chilies, the candle nuts and the garlic, etc., a few spices. And then it would go into a big broth. So there was a second process to the cooking, and that's where all the chilies were as well. So it was very, very hot. You had to be a little bit careful if you're not primed for that kind of food heat. Mm. But it was a spectacularly tasty dish, much more so than the side dishes, which were pretty consistent and standard as I'd had around the rest of the area. But that catfish was just amazing. And the people who were attending there, who were dining there, they were in their uniform, there were the policemen, there were some quite well-dressed people that weren't just, you know, not just the neighbourhood diners. It's a real destination, I think, for the local people.
And extraordinary that you were able to hunt it out. Mm.
Traditional, so not full of tourists or anything like this. It's really sounded...
I would say there's probably some Javanese tourists.
Javanese tourists, but not Westerners or...
I didn't see any Westerners when I was there. In fact, I didn't see any Westerners when I was in Surakarta at all either. That was pretty much tourist-free. It's not like Bali in that way. You see relatively few, but, you know, with an island of 130, 140 million people, there's... You know, Java has a lot of its own tourism. Mm.
Indeed,
yes,
it would.
Of course, it would.
So did you find that there was obviously much less English spoken, so your Bahasa would have got a little bit of a workout?
It did. Like, it's a great place to improve your Bahasa. But a lot of people, I would say a great many, had sufficient English to get by. If you were both sort of prepared to be patient and articulate your words and be very sort of particular in how you ask for things, you could get by. So it wasn't impossible.
Oh, that is good to know. And then, well, we were going to also quickly touch on what is good egg?
Yes, so gudeg is this key dish that is quite popular in that particular part of Central Java. And so it takes sort of a young jackfruit, and I think they smash it quite a lot and then sort of cook it in coconut milk and with some palm sugar. So it ends up being sort of a vegetable dish, but it's a bit more on the sweet side, which is not sort of really what my palate's accustomed to. But aside from that, there's a lot of chicken dishes, of course, as sort of like the main protein dish there. And, of course, no pork in that part of the country. And, you know, beef's pretty expensive. But they have, you know, the equivalent of Kentucky Fried Chicken, I suppose, Java Fried Chicken and Smash Chicken and so many variations.
Well, if you're not a chicken appreciator, that could be a challenge. But there was plenty of tofu dishes, lots of vegetable dishes.
And tempeh being the fermented tofu dish that is a creation of Indonesia. And I'm hoping, and it's starting to happen, you know, it's becoming a lot more widely available. So it's much more interesting, I think, than just regular tofu. It's got a lot more texture to it. Being fermented, it's probably a little bit better for you. It's interesting.
Joycast is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
This is the Escape Hour. Our guest is Michelle Matthews, editor of The Lucky Guides. The Lucky Guides, of course, have covered food and beverage in Melbourne and also food and beverage in Bali. How's the San Sebastian Spain guide coming along?
Coming along well. Hoping to release them both for Bilbao and the surrounding area of Biscaya, as well as San Sebastian and Gipuzkoa, that region, as ebooks in the next month.
Well, we'll have to have you back again down the track to talk about that. But back to eating and drinking and travelling around Java. If what would be your top tips for someone who was travelling to Jogja and Solo in Java to do other than go to the major temples?
Well, there is one, I suppose, a secular temple of sorts that's quite fascinating. It's colloquially known as the Chicken Church. The Chicken Church. So it's actually quite close to Bukit Rema. It's called Bukit Rema, but it's quite close to Borobudur. So the Chicken Church was created by a gentleman, I think, in the 1990s, and it was intended to be a purely secular place to pray. Or I suppose multi-denominational. So any religion, anyone could go to this church and pray. It was a beautiful idea. It was in the jungle. It is shaped like a giant dove and all the symbolism of peace, etc. But most people refer to it as the Chicken Church because it does look an awful lot like a chicken. So it's one of the few places that I went to that is becoming more of a tourist attraction, but it wasn't overrun by tourists. And it wasn't one of these places like Borobudur and Prambanan where you get charged as a foreigner the equivalent of about $35 compared to just a few coins if you're a local.
Oh, well, that's a good point.
So that was appealing. And so once you're at the Chicken Church, you can go right up to the top. The chicken wears a sort of a crown. And from the top, you can actually look across the area. You can see some of the volcanoes and you can see Borobudur. It's a bit fuzzy, but you can tour through the different sections, which are sort of designed for maybe Islamic prayer or Catholic prayer, etc. And then there's also some lovely sort of restaurants and cafes at the tail section of the chicken.
Oh, so, I love it. They put the restaurants in the tail.
Yes. So that was a fantastic place to visit because it was just so unexpected, so different. Another fun thing to do in Yogyakarta is right downtown. There's like a hippodrome, sort of like this circular area. And they get these cars that look like conventional cars, like a you know, Volkswagen, etc. But they're a bit more Flintstone style. So you have to pedal with your feet to make them go. And so you go around the circle and they're covered in neon lights that sort of flash and they're fun. And so you just grab a group of friends and you just drive around this sort of relatively small circle, eat the street food from the stalls that are on the side and just have a bit of a hoot.
That sounds really, really fun. And what about, you know, museums and, you know, things like that? Is there a lot of those in Jogja because it's the centre of the arts?
There are some. I didn't visit a lot. There is the Kraton, which is the name for the palace. Mm-hmm. There is an underground mosque, which is quite an interesting thing to see. It's quite an old city itself, though. So one of the fantastic things to do is just take a walk through the back streets.
Walking is always the very best.
It is.
Get yourself a walking tour.
It is. Well, I was very fortunate. As I mentioned before, one of the places I stayed was this old converted mansion. And the owner happened to just turn up that night, that same day that we were there. And so she very, very kindly just took us on a couple of walking tours, two mornings in a row, through the area, through the back streets. And this is a very wealthy area with lots of sort of silver shops. So, if you're interested in silver jewellery or silver products, that would be the place to go. But just walking through the different streets, you get to appreciate the variation in architecture. And again, we saw more wells that are still active today. Mm-hmm. And you see all the little details. And before you know it, you stumble across some of the different mosques, because it's all very much built into the community. They're not sort of standalone like a lot of them you might see in different parts of Southeast Asia and Malaysia, for example, or the Middle East. Mm. But just these little areas are fantastic to watch and to see life go by. And, of course, always visit the markets. Mm. That's always the most fascinating thing.
So markets for food or for just...
Well, for everything. There was actually one of the markets in Solo, which is an antique market. Mm. So visiting that was just fascinating because you see all these different eras of history represented by... so many different elements, physical products. Mm. So one lady was selling old currency and there was just beautiful currency that you just like to own because it was like a work of art. There was a lot of the stamps used to make the batik, so you could buy those. And they're quite beautiful pieces of, of pattern. Mm. And a lot of different elements from just different times. Things that didn't make any sense, but you'd ask and it was, maybe an old coffee grinder from Dutch times, for example. There was just so much to see. So if you're an antique fan, the antique market in Solo, Surakarta, is pretty fascinating, made up of dozens and dozens, possibly hundreds of individual different stalls, all specialising in specific things.
So it's like a souk or a medina?
Yeah, in a sense, it is.
Well, it's one of my favourite things is to wander through the medinas and souks. And also you get to chat to the storeholders are always so interested in talking and introducing you to, their culture. And so it's a great opportunity for engagement. And also you can take a chance. I mean, I was wandering around the souks of Tunis and a gentleman... approached me and asked me if I wanted to see an amazing view over the souk, and I went, oh, okay. Mm. Oh. And so he took me down a side street and then into a shop and then at the back of the shop, and then we walked up the back stairs and we could see out over the medina and the souk area, which was really fantastic. And I think he wanted me to buy something from the shop, which I managed to get my way out of that. But
I was going to say, I'm always quite wary. Wary of this thing because I'm thinking they're going to rob me blind or just
it is
kill
good
me
to be wary.
Back alley.
It is good to be wary, I guess, and have your wits about you at all times for sure. So the markets are always a central place that I visit whenever aside from the fact that obviously it's shopping. There's the retail component, and when I'm in a food market overseas, I always want to. I mean, I can't do anything with the fruit and vegetables that I can see, and because you want to buy them because there's mountains of them, because they don't have the nice, neat stalls or markets that we have. There's like a pile of, like 6 foot pile of carrots, for example. Anyway, so it's always so tempting to buy, but you can't always use what you buy.
No, and you can't bring it back.
And you can't bring it back, exactly. Any purchases of note? While you were there, any sort of, significant little purchases that will remind you of the destination?
I didn't actually buy that much, no. Other than, as I mentioned before, a little bit of the batik. But no, I mean, a lot of the things I would have liked to buy would be consumables. Mm. So the things from the market. I'm not a smoker, but there was a lady selling tobacco, which I found quite fascinating because she wasn't just selling one kind of tobacco. She had maybe even more than a dozen different kinds. And I don't know if it was different grades, different, you know, different strains or whatever, but that was quite fascinating that there was just so much variety. And that's what you don't get in markets here. Mm. You think a banana is a banana, but you go to somewhere like Indonesia and you realize there can be so many kinds of bananas, and they often taste a lot better than the ones we're accustomed to.
Absolutely.
And totally unfamiliar vegetables and fruits, and it's just mind-blowing to appreciate just how diverse the world is. And the older you get, to still find there is fruits and vegetables and so many things that are common one place and completely unfamiliar to you.
That's one of the main reasons why we travel, is to see things that we don't see every day or possibly have never seen before.
And it's delightful. I travel to be delighted, not so much impressed by five star, but that's delighted.
Now, in terms of, I just wanted to ask you, so it wasn't an organised tour and everything, you do everything yourself. So how is it to go between places? So from Yogyakarta to Solo, how do you do that? Do you hire a driver or do you rely on public transport? I think it might be interesting to know this little detail.
Well, I did get to Yogyakarta via Denpasar Airport, so I just flew in, but it is possible to catch the ferry, but it takes a while to get around in Bali to get to that point. Then within the within that area, Central Java itself, I used private drivers, which are relatively easy to find. You know, you can ask it at receptions or at desks at the airport, etc. What I would be very, very keen to do in the future, though, is to travel by rail. So Java, having such a large population and being really very long and spread out, has a very, very active rail network. Yes, thank you. And on top of that, there's lots of different elements, or sort of, I suppose, levels to it. So they've introduced some quite luxury travel options now. So you can, I think travel in maybe 9 hours from sort of one side of the country to the, of the island to the other in comfort, sort of more like airline style seats that I think recline not the full 180, but I think it's 170 degrees.
Oh, that's quite impressive.
So it's quite impressive, yes. And, you know, Indonesia's got, you know, it's a different currency. It's more of a developing nation. So it's not nearly as expensive as the rail journeys almost everywhere else in the world, which are often super expensive when you're going at a luxury level.
Going from Darwin to Adelaide, which will cost you a lot of money.
Exactly.
Have you done that trip?
I haven't. I've wanted to do it, but it's too expensive.
I think that my mother and father have done it because they think that they love that sort of thing.
I think if you don't want to travel in a seat, it's really expensive.
It is. And, I mean, I'm sure that slow travel, of course, has resurfaced as a current travel trend. And if you can't afford to do it, you could just rent it on SBS and watch it on demand.
My parents are actually just about to disembark from Perth now, from the Indian Pacific, which goes from Sydney across.
Wow.
And because they're more advanced age, 90 and 85, they didn't want to stay in the bunks on board. So, yes, it's super pricey when you have to, you know, choose the beds, but worth it.
Well, I think that it would be worth it, and certainly when you get to a ripe old age, not only that, you probably deserve a bit of a lie
down. That's right.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
You're listening to The Escape Hours with Fiona Stefan and our guest Michelle Matthews, who we've been travelling all across Java, Indonesia. So in terms of LGBTIQ safety in Indonesia, Bali is very safe because of being Hindu. So I think people need to be mindful that it's a Muslim island.
Yes.
We hear about a lot of Aceh which is, I think they do stone gay people,
they do.
A bit similar to the Sharia law.
It's shocking that we even have to mention that on the radio.
But I think it's something we cover a lot in things, being aware, being aware of it when you go. So, you know, PDAs and things like this. It's not deterring people from going, but being very aware that it's just familiarize yourself with the laws of the country, like you would do for anything. And if you're in a Muslim country, modesty, all this kind of things that we talk about a lot here, and your personal, and it's where your compass, your personal safety compass as well, where you want to.
I mean, I think also to keep in mind is that public affection in between heterosexual couples is unusual in those environments as well.
Absolutely.
Travel with care.
Yes.
We would advise, as we know. Now,
we've got one more question for Michelle, I think.
We have got one more question. It's the escape hour question that we ask everyone. Da, 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 da. We need music for this question.
Yes, we do.
We
do.
The question is, do you roll or do you fold?
Oh, I'm a folder.
She's a folder. We got a folder in the house.
You're a folder, Fiona?
I'm a roller folder.
Oh, I'm a folder. I can't roll. Unless it's hand luggage, which proved very handy when my flight was delayed by 26 hours last week.
Oh my God. I didn't want to hear about that.
26 hours.
That's excruciating. Well, we love travel, but sometimes travel just doesn't work.
And you have to be pragmatic about it. There's nowhere I could have gone. So, you know, you're held captive somewhere. There's no point getting annoyed because really it's not going to get you anywhere different.
No, that's true. But when none of us are Zen masters. So
No, but...
It can be frustrating.
It can be.
Thank you for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.